Welcome once again to the Lime Leaf Podcast. I'm John. I'm joined by Blaine and Mubs, fellas.
How you doing?
Good morning.
We are also joined by Corey Snipes. Corey Snipes is a software developer and systems builder with 25 years of experience across security, cloud, and web-facing technologies. Corey likes to fix things, spend time in the woods, and play music. He's also a founding member of our new Henhouse Computing Co-op, which we'll discuss a bit later. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Excited to have you. We're going to talk today about small tech, digital sovereignty, and then also, as I said, we're going to talk a little bit about Henhouse, what we're doing there. So Corey, you're our guest, so we want to talk to you as much as possible. No one wants to hear from you, especially me. So tell us about how you got into tech, what you're working on today, your passions in tech, and then we'll segue into what small tech is, why it matters, and all the rest of it. But let's start with you.
Sounds great. Well, I'm happy to be here. I have a lot of respect for the work that you guys do. I've followed the podcast with interest, and you guys with interest since I think first found Blaine probably on Mastodon.
Yeah, most people do.
But I got, so my path to get into tech was the usual direct route. I got a bachelor's in psychology. I worked as a stagehand. I delivered pizza for a while. I tinkered with my own machine to try and get it up to snuff to do some multiplayer gaming. All of that was kind of, I would say ancillary interest while I was figuring out what I wanted to do in life. I mean, I think currently I'm a software and systems guy, but the real actual path to that started with hardware tinkering. It started with tech support. I got a job doing tech support. I got a slightly better job doing tech support. It was not the career that I set out to have for myself going into college or even graduating from college. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I knew that I had kind of an affinity for computers and
what did you study in college?
Psychology.
Okay.
Bachelor's in psychology. So, it's probably actually somewhat relevant to the work that I'm doing now, but it's not, this was not a carefully woven together path up front.
Yeah. I mean, I have an English degree. I have no business working in tech, but when I was a kid, I monkeyed around with computers and so tell us a bit about what you're doing today. So Get Review Star, things like that, because you're a builder, obviously. So tell us about some of the things you're building or have built or whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah. So I do professionally I do a few things. I mean, most of the sort of day job money work comes in through systems engineering and analysis. I work for an agency out of Washington, D.C. I work in the aviation airspace kind of advanced concept arena. And I did not get there, through direct path from my course of studies. I had a lot of lucky breaks along the way. And I think at my age, I sort of hit the demand curve at just the right time too. Yep. I worked for a large agency in the dot-com era. I had a, reasonably good network from that. I had some software skills from that. And I just ended up getting a lot of work at a time when software people were still relatively hard to find.
Yep.
I think through several lucky breaks and people giving me a shot when maybe I didn't deserve it, ended up where I am. But so that's the day job. But it's very interesting work. I work for, mainly two federal agencies that, are involved with airspace and air traffic management, that kind of thing. On the side, for the last 11 years, I've run a little online application review platform. It started out as a call for speakers thing for conferences, but it's really kind of a general purpose application and review and scoring builder. It's called Review Star, and it's a little monolithic stack. It's built in Node, but I run it. I run it on my own servers, and I've gone through some de-googling and big tech to small tech transitions with that application over the last few years. And the other thing that I have going right now is what I like to call the laptop rehabilitation project. So I've acquired a few surplus, often Lenovo, sometimes Dell, pick up surplus equipment from time to time and either upgrade it or just wipe it and set it back into the world afresh with Linux or something a little more low resource usage.
Cool.
And just donate. I just give them away to people who are interested, either locally or, you know, usually kind of in exchange for shipping.
Awesome. Yeah, I was looking at that website. That's a really cool thing to do.
Oh, thanks.
So much of it out there, obviously. There's just so much hardware that just gets literally dumped into landfills.
Especially now. I mean, to me, a big motivator for that was just seeing how much perfectly usable equipment is just being, you know, dumped and outmoded because of the demands of, you know, mainly Microsoft, Windows.
Yep. Well, you and I are old. I don't know if Blaine and Mubs remember the one laptop per child program. Yeah. I don't know if that's even still going on, but at the time I thought that's a great idea, but then I was also like, well, there's just a lot of hardware out there that, like, you don't need to really build anything. If Linux wasn't quite a thing then, though, like, you really couldn't run another operating system on it. But cool. So we want to get into talking about small tech, why it matters. But the first thing we need to do is define what it is, because not everyone agrees. The way that I think a lot of people, especially now, look at it is like, well, it's not big tech. As long as, you know, you're not using Google or Microsoft Windows or whatever, you're doing small tech. And it's not quite that. I mean, I think the way I would define it is that, you know, it's software built at a human scale, usually for, you know, specific communities of people, and its motivation is not just to grow infinitely, which, you know, even small software projects, a lot of them, the ambition is to raise money, make a bunch of money, cash out, do an exit. And the small tech ethos is, I don't think embraces that. And it's very closely aligned with open source, because most small tech products and projects tend to be open source, just as a matter of, like, that's kind of the ethics of how it all works. So as you mentioned, like, we went through a big teching recently. Yesterday, I believe, was our last Google Workspace. We haven't used it for like a month. We've migrated everything, but they finally sent us our notice of, like, you're done. Sorry, you can't log in anymore, all that stuff. But the main thing we replaced that with is something called Nextcloud, which is something you can host yourself. We do host it ourselves. We use a small tech platform called Peekapods, which is very cool. And we'll put all these links in the show notes, but I don't know if I would define Nextcloud as a small tech project, because it has hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of users. I mean, a lot of nonprofits use it, a lot of organizations use it. So anyway, how do you, Corey, like, what in your mind, as you've been thinking about all this stuff for the last decades, literally, like, how do you think about it, and what does it mean to you?
I tend to follow the what it's not model. I think so many, especially now, I think that the prevailing message or the prevailing culture around technical, you know, people who want to put something online, people who want to build something, is you must, you know, these are the de facto tools, the Microsoft tools, the Amazon web services. These are the things that everybody's using. So these are the things, and, you know, if you want to get started, it's free. So I think it's really, you know, they've done a really nice job of being kind of out in front of, like, oh, these are the obvious ways to get started. The big, you know, Amazon and Google and companies like that. I think, you know, small tech to me is a collection of people who say, actually, no, there are other tools. I want to use these other tools to do it, because I either, you know, I don't want the embedded gatekeeping. I don't want the included, extractive economy that comes along with this. I don't want the data collection. You know, the way that these companies provide stuff for free is they're, you know, using the data that you're putting into the systems and monetizing that. And that's, you know, they have a business to run. And so to me, the small tech is both people who are creating tools and people who just want to put stuff online. They want to connect with their communities, or they want to share something, or they want to build something. And they just don't, you know, they want to use a set of alternatives or create alternatives where they don't exist. So,
yeah, in there, you, all of what you just said, like, sort of made, reminded me of, it, it feels like it's also more transparent too. Like this thing, this little tiny tool that you built that serves that population of people could be deployed on Google Cloud, but then it, you just threw this into this black box of data extractive, like data collection kind of system, as opposed to, no, it's running on this VPC in like that just happens to be a Knox Center 2 miles down the street, and I signed up through their portal and I got my single binary running on a VPC right down the street. So it's sort of less technical-ish, but it's more transparent. And you know, the other lens seems to be sustainability too, like long-term, to sort of serve that exact population of people.
Yep, I would agree with that 100%. And the sustainability angle is interesting too, because I think that's, it could have the, you know, sustainability means different things to different people. It could be, you know, sort of environmental sustainability, but it could also just be sustainability for your own project. You know, there's so many instances where building on someone else's platform results in you either having to spend a lot of time in major upgrades, or just suddenly finding yourself without a tool, or suddenly finding yourself without with a, you know, quadrupled bill. It's sustainability for you as the kind of the project owner as well.
I think for me too, I feel like these days it's very hard to own anything. Like we rent a lot. And even when we try and buy things, I feel like there's still like, we're not, do we really own them, or does the bank own them, or, you know, all these other things. I think with tech, I think it's swung, you know, way to the, we just rent everything. We rent a space, a little space in a big server. And I feel like small tech is like, is we can't go all the way to like owning stuff, but just swinging the pendulum back a little bit where it feels like we're actually paying us for a service and we use the service and we kind of own the service as opposed to renting a little bit of a thing. And I think the more that we can kind of do things like that, the more that we can, you know, it does, you know, kind of, as Blaine said, with the transparency aspect as well, but it does feel like you own the thing, you paid for the thing, you use the thing, and you own the thing for a while at least. And so, yeah, so I think that to me is also an aspect of it. It's not the only aspect to it, obviously, but that is for me a kind of important thing as well.
Yeah, I agree. Which is weird because, you know, 10 years ago when we were all doing PHP WordPress sites, like where would you host this stuff? Literally on the same stuff that we're using now, and we're defining as small tech, but like 10, 15, 20 years ago, you were running it on Bluehost or pick your favorite PHP WordPress host. Doing that as a developer didn't feel like I was sort of selling my soul, right? I signed up, I uploaded the site, it worked, it was great. I felt like I still owned my site at that point, but none of that underlying tech has changed. The time that we just like went through completely defined now what we used to have.
Yeah, and cloud computing was the big factor there. Like, and not necessarily, as you said, the tech, but the pricing structure. Like, I remember at the time I was working for a company that did video encoding and storage. And when EC2 and S3 came out, we were like, oh, well, we don't have to buy a server, because back then, you know, our website for this company I worked for was running in a closet 10 feet from my desk. Like, yeah. But with cloud computing, it is like, well, don't worry. You don't worry about how many servers this takes. You just use it and use as much of it as you want. Obviously, you're going to pay us. This is the other trap that people got into, is you get, you know, stuck there and then you can never leave. I worked for another company that happened to. But just this conceptual, like, well, don't worry about servers and bandwidth. It just use as much of it as you want. And that did enable gigantic scaling of everything, like startups. And, you know, instead of saying, well, okay, step one for our startup is we're going to go and buy a rack server from Dell. And, you know, that's like, well, no, like just get an AWS account and you're on your way. And now there's, you know, basically what, three or four big cloud computing platforms that, you know, everything runs on them. And that's one of the things that one of the reasons we wanted to do this episode is what you start to see in the last few years, especially, is people being like, well, first of all, I don't need it. I don't need to scale to 100,000 EC2 instances, which is not what I'm doing. All I want to do is this, you know, my personal website. I don't need AWS to do that. So that's why I wanted to talk about some of the like examples that we've seen. And Corey, I want to hear about some of the ones that you've seen that we think are doing this and doing it well. There's a guy named Arl. We all don't know him personally. His name's Arl Balkin. He's Irish. He literally started something called the Small Tech Foundation. And we'll have the links to this stuff in the show notes. But he's very, what's the word, stridently anti-big tech, I mean, which we respect and admire. But he's working on something called Kitten, which is sort of like a web app framework specifically for the small tech ethos. For a while, I was using something called Bear Blog, which is, I think, a guy in South Africa, maybe. I don't remember where he's locating, but it's, you know, it's a blog hosting thing. It's very simple. It's $5 a month. I mentioned Peekapods, Mastodon, which we'll get into later when we start talking about this sort of movement to decentralize social media. OMG LOL, if people haven't seen that, that's a very cool thing that is, again, it's just for creating a personal space, because it has other things than a website. But so these kind of things where it's like, well, yeah, I don't, you know, I want to spend less time on Facebook or whatever, or social media, TikTok. I just want to have my little corner of the internet, and this whole movement back to, like, you know, your personal space on the web where people can really have a sort of a more genuine connection with you, and there's nothing else involved there. There's no algorithm trying to shove other people's content in your face all the time. So those are some of the ones, you know, that I think are pretty cool and have inspired us to build what we're building now, which is the Hen House thing, which we'll talk about later. But I don't know, Corey, what are some of the things that you're seeing and using?
I agree that those are excellent examples. I've encountered them, you know, independently, mm-hmm. As well, and I totally agree with that list. I might add to it Ghost, the publishing and plus newsletter plus, you know, monetizing in a way, you know, like financial platform. I think they did a great job of taking what people liked about Substack and creating a set of tools that gives you all of those functions, but allows you to control the content completely. You could self-host it.
Yep.
You can. There are a couple, or, you know, several companies that just provide Ghost hosting for you, and, you know, Ghost, mm-hmm. the organization themselves, you can pay them to host it for you, which is excellent, and it helps keep their project sustainable. But it's also open enough that you can run it yourself. You could have Synapse Media run it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know a lot of people who were either did use Substack or have tried Ghost and are just delighted with it. I think that's a great project. Micro.blog is a great place for non-technical people who maybe, you know, I want to jump into this. I can see the value of, like, digital sovereignty and, you know, owning my own stuff, but I don't really, you know, I don't want to deal with the stack, or I don't have the chops to even try this or whatever. Mm-hmm. Microblog is a good place to start for folks like that. And I think that's another, like, small team, good ethos. And then there's a for eight, you know, kind of in the weeds for development stuff. Postman is a pretty popular API testing platform. there's a smaller project, much smaller project called Bruno, which basically took the whole user interface. And they basically give you Postman without all the cloud requirement, you know, online login, give us your data stuff. They are very, you know, vocally anti-VC and anti-cashing out. They just wanted to make a sustainable project that did great, you know, the great things that Postman did for you. So I think that's a cool project too.
Yeah, that one's really cool. I was playing with that last week. So I think as an, you know, undercurrent of all the small tech discussion, it's really about data, I think, at the end of the day. Like, that's what I think a lot of people don't think about, like, well, you know, I don't need all the cloud computing. It's more that, like, well, I don't want my data, like, being used by these companies for increasingly, you know, one of the, obviously, you know, a huge shift in all this was when the Trump administration showed up and all these tech companies, which I don't know if I was shocked, but I was certainly like, wow, they are all in with this guy. Like, you know, and that really makes you think, like, well, okay, yeah, everything I do is all day long is using these platforms, and what are they really doing with all that data? Now we know, I mean, AI training, LLM stuff is a lot of it. That's why I think Google is going to completely run away with that, because they've got all, literally all the data. So that's what it's all about. But anyway, so digital sovereignty comes up in this whole conversation. And, you know, the term, I think, kind of got coined back in 2021. There were some EU prime ministers, presidents that wrote this letter to the EC president proposing something. And they said that we need to be digitally sovereign. And because even then, this is 21, people are, you know, forget that, like, a lot of this was happening before Trump showed up. Europe, a lot of countries were increasingly concerned that American tech companies just had too much control, not only control over their data, but what they were doing with it. In a lot of cases, especially in Europe, it was literally illegal. Like, they're like, what these people are doing is illegal. Like, they should not be allowed to do this. Anyway, so on a more personal level, like, data ownership, how, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how could we recommend to people that they take back? Because it's a tough question, because on one hand you're like, well, yeah, take back your data, don't, but then it's like, well, I want to participate in Instagram, or like, what am I supposed to do? Like, people like us are on Mastodon and all these sort of more alternative places, but a lot of people, I don't know, they would find that very attractive. I don't know. Anyway, I guess the question is, what are some alternatives or strategies that people can use? Is there a middle ground where you can still participate? And we'll get into AT protocol in a minute, but still participate in those things, but retain ownership and control of your data.
I think the POSSE model, POSSE, there's a talk by Molly White that she gave last year at South by Southwest. And I think that the concept may go back to Cory Doctorow. I don't know. It's an acronym that I see floated around, but I think it's super powerful. And it's basically a great answer in this situation. And it's publish on your own site, syndicate elsewhere.
Okay.
POSSE. And it is really the idea that you don't have to stop participating on Facebook and Instagram. If you're an artist or a musician, you would be suicidal to not, you know, to not put your information out where people, you know, are looking for it.
Yep.
So the model basically says you don't have to not participate in those places. If you want to just take some baby steps or just even change how you think about it, just start with your own site. So what Molly White does, what I think is great, she puts out a ton of content, super valuable. She's a fascinating person.
Yeah.
But she starts, like, the hub for all of that is her website, mollywhite.net. So everything that she writes goes up there. Everything that she writes gets recorded as an audio file also, and she puts it out as a podcast. Mm-hmm. And then she shares that. She participates in, she's on X, she's not, you know, the sort of person that hates X.
Yep.
But you know, she's on X, she's on Blue Sky, she's on Mastodon. She, like, because you have this hub of stuff, you know, if one of those platforms just goes super sideways,
yeah,
you still have all your stuff.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's a hassle, but it's a model, I think, that works really well, Posse.
And it's hard for some of the people that, like, are not on the technically savvy side, because
right,
the point and the big selling point for all of those platforms was just log in and here's a text box that will write literally your stream of consciousness into this text box and we'll just publish it for you and blast radius it out to the network world. And again, like, that was very powerful to give less technical people a voice online.
It works
but,
great.
But now we see the negative side effects of all of this, like, 10 years later, after all of these places are now, like, folks have learned that this is the only way that I can do this.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of novel that those kinds of folks could understand, like, oh, I could actually have my own website. Like, yes, it's, there is a little bit of a learning curve there, but places like, you know, the Bear blog and microblog and stuff like that are lowering the barrier of entry for some of this stuff to allow those folks to get in it. You know, there's other podcasting platforms that are doing the same thing. Mastodon, Loops, all the federated stuff. Blue Sky's doing it as a Vex alternative now too. So we're seeing that you're sort of taking back. That's part of, like, your sovereignty and your ownership of your data. Do you actually own it? Like, no, but it's, you can own it a little bit more and start to centralize it from your own, like, personal space.
Yep. Mubs, were you going to say something? I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does go back a little bit to the whole ownership versus kind of renting thing. I think, you know, a lot of people saw that even on Twitter and X, like, is your handle yours? Is your account yours? Same with YouTube and Instagram. You can spend years building up a following, building up a sort of archive of videos that you've posted. Somebody can send an abuse report and you've lost that overnight. And so, you know, so posting it on your own site, you know, at least people will, you know, through SEO and things like that, people will still find you, people can still find your content, at least, even if you are like, you know, removed from X and kind of YouTube and things like that. I think a large part of it has to do with education, right? Like, because I think people just don't realize that when they sign up for these platforms, they're renting space in that world. It's not theirs. It's not mm-hmm. permanent. I think recently, at least, X has started to reclaim inactive handles. Like, a lot of people that signed up very, very early had 3-4 letter handles.
They're
on X,
squatting on it.
Squatting on them. And, you know, X has just decided, well, you're not using them. They were never really yours because they're ours, and right, other people want to pay to use these short handles. We're going to sell them to these other people instead. And so people are starting to realize, you know, obviously it takes something to happen for people to kind of appreciate that, oh, that thing wasn't actually mine. And I think so. Yeah. So first step is just education in terms of, like, is that thing actually yours? And yeah. Even if you self-host things, you're still putting on a server somewhere. It's not your physical right. server. I mean, unless it's in yep. your office somewhere and it's on a physical yep. server, it's not really yours, but, you know, there's still elements of it that you control, that you have more control over, even if you don't have ownership over. And just kind of growing to the point that you can. I think to some degree as well, it kind of depends a little bit. Like, I think, like we said, some people don't really care, right? Like, they go on X, they post once a day or whatever, and if they lose their following, I don't think they care. But if you're doing it serious, if you're doing it to build a following, to build,
if you're living from it,
yeah, if you make a living from it, then understanding what is under your control and what's actually under control of big tech, I think, is like a huge thing that people have kind of spaced over.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, most of what we've talked about so far, I think, is focused on, you know, storage. Like, where is your website? But what we've seen in the last few years with the LLM companies is, okay, well, not only like, okay, your content, even if you put it on your small little web, someone can still just come along and scrape it all and use it to train a model that then they make billions of dollars on. Like, that's a hazy line. It's like, well, your website is quote unquote a public thing, but that doesn't necessarily give people the right to just, like 30, 40 years ago, you couldn't just go and photocopy every magazine and then start, you know what I mean? Like, there's copyright stuff gets very complex around this. And I think that's the other side of all this is like, well, yeah, but not only do I want to control, you know, whose hardware it's sitting on and make sure I'm not like giving them any money to keep doing things I don't agree with, but literally they'll just come along and take it. And
Yeah.
they've done this with YouTube. They've done that. I'm not, you know, that Google does it too. And again, they own all the con literally, like, there's copyright stuff, but at the end of the day, everything on YouTube, they can do whatever they want with, really. Like, but anyway, so sorry, go ahead, Corey.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, it's been a great disappointment to me to see how little protection copyright really affords individual creators. You know, I think people tend to view it as, you know, a firm legal protection, and it is for large organizations. But I've been surprised at how much has been done that just abandons copyright concerns entirely and says, okay, well, you know,
What's on
fight us
it?
for it if you want.
Yeah, that's what Sam Altman, all these people are like, well, it's on the internet. So, and that says goes all the way back to the original Google. You know, they're like, well, yeah, we're gonna index everything, but we're also gonna keep copies of it. And there were fights. I mean, people forget about the when I worked at Google, the week I showed up, they first that's when they had settled the Viacom case with YouTube. And so this is they've been pushing the envelope on this stuff for a long time, and they very intentionally push the envelope on what they can get away with that stuff because they know obviously how valuable the data is. And I think there's a lot of lawsuits cropping up now, but I think we're going to continue to see them just keep pushing and pushing to see what they can get away with.
I
Yeah, I
think,
think this,
go ahead.
no, go ahead, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that. Yeah, I think it is interesting. Obviously, we live in an international, we live in the world, as it were. But it is interesting to see that the laws and the rules are different in different parts of the world. It's hard to apply them, obviously, to corporations that are kind of over here and stuff. So what's allowed and what's legal in Europe isn't the same as what's allowed and what's legal here. I mean, obviously, the sort of legal system here is kind of letting AI companies do whatever they want at this point, just to try and get that sort of step ahead of kind of everybody else. Hopefully, at some point, those laws will kind of catch up and they'll put some guardrails in place. I mean, I think you're right, Corey. Like, unless you've got lots of money, it's very hard to kind of fight against these. I mean, I think the New York Times has filed against OpenAI and Claude as well, because they just because you publish content, it doesn't mean that people can then use that content for whatever means that they want to as well. But unless you've got the financial a bit and the sort of legal team to kind of oppose it, it's kind of out of your hands as well, unfortunately.
Especially now, oh boy, this is such a great federal legal environment for any technology company that wants to push the bounds of what was permissible or not.
The president literally said, "You're not allowed to make any laws about any of this stuff." Like, whether or not an
Yeah.
executive order, he obviously does a lot of things that he probably is not legally entitled to do. But like, the signal, and that's what it's more about, is the signal that it sends. Like, don't mess with these guys. I want them to be able to do whatever they want. So just looking at this from like, you know, the four of us are very obviously into this movement, and we hang out in places like Mastodon. So we kind of maybe are looking at this through a lens that I guess the point I'm making is this for real, or is this just a niche for weirdos like us? Like, are people, is a mainstream person really care about this? Does it matter? Like, if a lot of movements start small and gain momentum, is this one gaining momentum? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think it matters. I mean, I think to the extent that you can provide people with give people the ability to see another example of how to do things, whether it's somebody who thinks the internet is, this app on their phone, or somebody who's creating content and putting it out in the world and just feels like they're, chained to Facebook or whatever. I think to individual people it definitely matters. I view this small tech movement, is it gaining momentum? I think yes. Will it upend the way that everyone uses the internet? I don't think so. I mean, to me, we're like gardeners and small plot farmers who have decided, this is the way that we want to do things because we want to do them, be able to control most of how it's done ourselves, and we want to provide this stuff for our, ourselves or our families or our, small communities or whatever. But it's like farming and gardening and farmers markets versus grocery stores. I think grocery stores are, large organizations are always going to have economies of scale, and they provide so much, like shiny, new, great stuff that Americans love. I think there's always going to be the big grocery store of technology, and a lot of people will just always choose that because it's easier and they don't, care. For better or worse, I think that will always be the case, but I think it is still like critically important to do the kind of stuff that we're doing because it gives people who might want an alternative a way to see that.
Yeah, I think it's also, I think most people in the internet, I think the internet is set up as a consumption engine, right? Like, I think most people consume content on the internet. Most people don't create content. And so if you're not creating content, who owns the content? You don't really care. All you're doing is consuming it. And so for a large part of the mainstream, I don't think they're ever really going to care just because they don't, you can't own something if you've never created something. But I think of those people who are creating things, I think it's going to become increasingly more important to actually understand sort of ownership and kind of legal, your kind of legal options around the content that you've created. And yes, it may well not be like the de facto model because kind of as we've kind of outlined, it's very easy to get started in the big tech way of doing things. There's little outlay that you have to put out, there's a little tech understanding that you need to start using these things. But I think once you get past a certain size and a certain sophistication of your operation, that it starts to matter more. And so that's where I think education is still always going to be key because people are always going to start with the easy route, and then eventually they're going to get to the point where it's like, well, maybe just, maybe the easy way isn't the right way. And so having that option to switch out, I think, is going to be hugely important as well.
Right. If we talk about this as just purely tech, like it honestly doesn't matter at that point. It's when you start to layer in the social and ethical aspects to all of this stuff too, right? If you're running even your small business, right, medium business, that's a nonprofit foundation, right? The chances that your mission statement of your organization aligning with where you're hosting your website is going to be completely misaligned. And in a world where like trust is generally a little bit more fragile, you might want to consider an alternative purely for that fact. It's not a technical choice, it's a purely social choice. And like it sends those messages more so now than ever to the visitors of your site if they, I don't want to say like if they found out, like, oh my God, well, you're hosting your site, but like that's now just part of the equation that people are becoming more and more aware of. And but the problem with those folks and those organizations, like, they're not sure of what the alternative is. And so having those options and having that education that yes, it's like the website's just over here. It's not a technical change, really. It's like a minor tweak. But once you're over here, like the social impact is going to outweigh more than before. So and that's sort of like wrapped up in like the whole like small small tech thing. It's less, it's a little bit technical, but it's also way more social.
All right, the next thing I wanted to talk about just briefly is these decentralization of social media protocols that are, you know, gaining some traction. I think probably of the two, the one the most people have probably heard about is AT Protocol, but for, you know, practical purposes, it's Blue Sky. And just briefly, I'm not getting into a whole technical thing, but the way these basically work is, you know, the data, the things you're posting to the app, the network, your comments, everything is stored in a data repository that, like, you know, you theoretically can host it yourself. You could put your Blue Sky PDS on a Raspberry Pi in your house if you wanted to. I just moved mine to one called EuroSky. So all my Blue Sky stuff, I don't post a ton, but it's not hosted or stored on Blue Sky servers. It's on independent servers that are operated in Europe. ActivityPub Mastodon is a bit more complicated than that. I don't really get in too much into federation. The point being, like, there's sort of this movement to at least, you know, you're, like Moses had said earlier, you're still participating, but you can do it. Basically, you know, your data is stored in this kind of locker in your house. Other people can access it, but at the end of the day, if you want to close the door on that locker and not let anybody, you know, access it, you can archive it, and it's yours. Now, whether or not, you know, the social networks index that stuff and what they do with it, they still store copies of it, whatever. There's at least some amount of independence here. So I don't know, Corey, how much you've looked into AT Protocol, those kind of things.
No,
I mean, we're,
you know, I've learned the most about AT Proto from you guys, actually.
Okay, yeah, we're involved with it mostly because of Mubs and the Blue Sky directory is how. I mean, I've been on Blue Sky since it launched, but I never took the time to figure out exactly how it worked. Now I have a much better understanding of that. But so the free R feeds, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. That's another. This movement to kind of like not only have the data stored outside of there, but the feeds themselves. So Mubs, if you want to talk to that, you're more qualified to talk about how that stuff works than me.
Yeah, I think with social media specifically, there's a couple of different aspects to it, right? One is, okay, are my posts mine? Is my account mine? Is my following mine? Is my social graph mine? Or is it, you know, again, is it just something that the sort of social media platform is in charge of and kind of controls. Like it took lawsuits for people to be able to export their posts from Twitter, for example, things like that. Like it's my posts. I should be able to access all the things I've made since I joined the platform, and it wasn't very easy, and they didn't want you to be able to do it. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is, what's my experience like as well? Like, what's the algorithmic content look like when I log into Twitter and X? Like, is it really a following feed, or is it some modified thing that Twitter thinks I should look at rather than the content from the people that I follow? So there's that sort of aspect to it as well. And then you kind of get the third aspect, which is kind of related to that, but you know, where does the legal aspect come in? Like, what's allowed on the platform? What's censored on the platform? You know, freedom of speech kind of aspects and things like that. And I think, you know, a lot of these platforms, they've kind of evolved over time to kind of where they are now. And people have realized that, well, I actually want more control over those things. I actually want to be able to follow whoever I want to follow. And, you know, people should be allowed to say what they want to, up to certain edges, I suppose, but you know, but you shouldn't be banned because you said something people didn't like. It should be because you said something illegal.
Threatened somebody.
I think both the federated world and sites like Blue Sky are trying to solve a lot of those issues. So, as kind of John said, in terms of ownership of your content and your social graph and things like that, you know, they have different approaches to how they solve that. But with AT protocol, and with Mastodon and stuff, you have more control over your content and your handle and kind of things like that. They also, you know, things like the Blue Sky are actually giving more control over the feeds that you see as well. Like, you can build your own feed, and so you can control kind of what you're seeing a little bit more. And even and then with like the moderation aspects, that's another reason to run your own PDS at some point, and your own app view in sort of AT world, in terms of like what content is allowed and kind of not allowed and things like that as well. So there's different ways to solve the different things that people are concerned about. And I do think it's not 100% yet. There's still centralization. Like, even Blue Sky needed to implement age controls in terms of who's allowed on the platform, because if you want to be allowed, you know, in certain states, in certain countries, you have to allow those things if you're a multinational and you want to support these things. But obviously there's other PDSs that have kind of skipped those and said, if you don't want to do age restrictions, you can move your account over here and use the sort of AT protocol in this other way. So just having those options now, I think, is very cool. And obviously, if you agree with those restrictions that, you know, you have to be a certain age to use social media, then you can move your account to whichever place that you want to kind of consume this content. So I think having options, I think, is always good. And then having the ability technically to be able to do all of these things is the sort of other aspect that people didn't really think about until it started happening. And then obviously once it started happening, it was like, okay, how do we solve this moving forward? And I think more importantly, what's happening with AT protocol specifically is that we're putting in the infrastructure that allows us to do these things. We're not just moving to a new site because it doesn't have those restrictions that eventually will have its own issues that we're not going to be able to kind of work around, versus we're putting infrastructure in place now that actually gives us fundamental access to all of these things and allows us to control these things. And yeah, not everybody's going to have the technical ability to kind of do those things. But again, as we talked about, there's the like the 1 or 2% that create, you know, that manage the content. There's the 10% that create the content. And so giving these tools to those folks, I think, is important. But yes, there's going to be 80, 90% of people who don't care about those things, but having the keys to be able to do these things and having those keys in the right hands, I think, is still really important.
Yeah, that's why I think like having the argument to own your data is not the right way to discuss it. The only way to own your data is to have the server sitting next to me that I can wipe. It cannot be copied. That is the only guarantee. Once that data is not on a system that I literally can touch, there is no fundamental way to prove that data does not exist on that server. I can't go and see the bytes on the disk. So it's just a very blurry line, and I don't think that's like part of the conversation. What you were talking about, Mubs, was exactly right. It's I want to own my data, but I really want to own the choice around my data. I want to choose what data I see, what data I expose, what data I interact with others, how I can move it from one place to another, still connected to this ecosystem of people, whether it's my website, my social network, or anything like that. Because, like, fundamentally, like with the way the internet is built right now, you can't just get online by putting a server in your house. We're just not there yet. Maybe will we get there? Maybe. But having the conversation around the choice of owning that choice and owning that data and what to do with it—that's the thing. It's owning the data itself is not in the conversation yet, unfortunately.
I think having those choices and you know, storage locations and capabilities codified in the standards or the protocols for, you know, for all of this is super powerful, because I think the protocols themselves are community built. They are largely independent of, you know, large organization influences. They're mostly, you know, buy in for the people in a way. The protocols drive the infrastructure, and the infrastructure determines what you can and can't do. And I think focusing on things like ATProto and ActivityPub and, you know, all the other sort of decentralization related protocols is a great way to you know, spend our energy.
It does remind me a lot. I mean, a lot of this conversation it's kind of funny. It kind of because kind of everybody's email address, like that to me is like that's the original decentralized way that we started to operate. Everybody had their own domain and their email, and then suddenly Hotmail and Gmail kind of popped up, and they kind of started to centralize all of those things as well. And we kind of swung the other way. And I know I've moved away from, I don't want a Gmail account anymore. I want it to be on my personal site. The reason that we're able to do a lot of things is because we use these SMTP protocols and even things like POP3 that allow anybody to host the server, and you can kind of host your own email on these standards. And I think obviously with social media, we didn't have these standards. And so now that we're starting to see these standards appear and a lot of people kind of sign up for them, and actually those standards start to get traction. Obviously on AT Protocol, we've got 43 million accounts now. You know, we're starting to see significant adoption of these standards. The more people we see using these standards, the more we'll see sort of alternative offerings and kind of things like that too. So yes, I love the fact that email still exists in pretty much the same standard that was published 20-30 years.
I mean, this whole newsletter thing, the whole newsletter phenomenon, people literally making tens of millions of dollars a year now sending emails. I think the professor at Boston College, Notes from an American, I think it's her Substack, I don't know if this is true, but I heard on another podcast the other day that she makes $10 million a year from that thing, and it's email. But Errol, our friend Errol Balkin, wants to go one step further, and he has this whole idea of internet numbers, where he's like, you have a phone number, everybody can memorize that, why can't they just memorize your IP address? So who are you? And then you exchange IP addresses with people you know. He's not talking about doing this at Facebook scale or whatever, but domain is cool, but also just tell them the IP address, and you know, they can memorize that. You can memorize a 10-digit phone number. You can surely, what, the IP address is maximum 12 digits? So.
Until we get to IP6, but yeah.
Let's not even get into that. Nobody uses that anyway.
Let's be honest, we're never going to get there. Right. Ship has sailed.
So I want to wrap up with Hen House. Let's see. What is Hen House? Hen House Computing Cooperative, as we're calling it, henhouse.coop. You can go there to learn a little bit about it and link to a place where we're raising some money. Don't get worried. It's $5,000. We're not talking VC levels of money here. So the idea is that this will be a cooperative that does cloud computing services, for lack of a better word. But to start, it's just going to be static web hosting. So if you wanted to host your website on Hen House, you will be able to just upload your files there, and they will magically appear on the web. We'll take care of all the really nerdy stuff like SSL certs and all that crap for you. You'll be able to use your own domain name with it, or, you know, we'll give you a free subdomain of our site, but most people are going to want to use their own domain. We'll make that easy. That's gotten significantly easier than it was like 10 years ago to do that. We opened it up to a few of our friends. We're looking for beta testers. Anybody out there, if you want to test Hen House, if you have a small site, you want to just, you know, put some files up there, see what happens, reach out to us at info@henhouse.coop or any of the addresses that you see on our website. So for us, I think this is not a money-making scheme. It's a money-making scheme, but it's not a get-rich scheme. It's structured it will be structured. It's not this way today because, again, we need to get the legal entities set up and everything. But when it is finally incorporated, it will be as a cooperative, which means that the members of the cooperative own the thing. Anybody will be able to use it. You'll be able to host a website in Henhouse without being a member of the co-op. But if you are a member of the co-op, you will get a vote in how the thing is operated. Democratic management is a cornerstone of cooperatives. So you'll have a say in that, but you'll also, you know, if it makes what we in the co-op world call a surplus, what capitalists call profits, that surplus will be divided among all the members. So you'll, you know, be earning money hopefully someday. Not again, you're not going to buy a Jeff Bezos yacht with this money. But, you know, a few extra shekels here and there. So, yeah, that's what it looks like from my seat. I don't know, Mubs and Blaine, if you guys want to. And Corey, you are a contributor and someday member of the, because you gave us $50. Thank you very much. So, guys, I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've all four of us have sort of experienced, like, I just want to post my personal site somewhere, whether it's, you know, GitHub pages years and years ago, or like Netlify or Cloudflare or something like that, or like an AWS bucket that's exposed to as a website. Like, there's always been a need for getting files on a server so some other person can type an address in a browser and see them. Like, that's been the fundamental drive for doing all of that. But Henhouse is supposed to play more on like the small tech space, small web space of like, okay, well, if we could really distill down what those features actually are, that's what we're building with Henhouse. You know, it's also planned to be like, it already is, it's open source. So if you do want to run it and sort of configure it yourself on your own subdomain, it is going to be, you know, going to be able to do that with some configurations with, you know, Let's Encrypt and certs. If you understand all the levels enough to be able to pull that off, that's totally fine. You know, go enjoy it. But, you know, we did want to offer it as a hosted option. But then as part of that product itself is doing what all John just said. That's like, if we want to add, you know, we're not going to launch with analytics and site stats off the bat. You can do that if you want to upload files with your own Google Analytics scripts. You want to make that choice. That's your website. Go have fun. Great. If you don't, like, maybe the cooperative in 6 months is 10, 20 folks strong, and we all collectively agree, like, oh, there would be a cool product feature to add per site analytics for folks that are just don't understand analytics and you want to give that offering. We'll all vote on that. It gets added to the product, and then it gets released as the self-hosted version. And that's how we want to like approach this long term.
And then after that, it's crypto coins. just kidding. Well, if people vote, you know, it's a democratically operated or, you know, hen coin.
Co-op coin.
Hey, now you're talking. I still need to do some thinking about that credit union whole thing I wanted to do, but. So I don't know, as we wrap up, Corey, I just, what do you think? So are you optimistic about where tech is heading? I mean, it's with AI, LLM, all the shit every day. It's just, it can be so overwhelming just keeping track of what the hell is going on, not to mention all the political stuff that's happening. So what are your thoughts? Where are we with tech?
It's easy to be pessimistic about tech. I, for direction, I am actually super optimistic because I think, you know, in my view, the core infrastructure of what all of this is, the core tools that somebody uses to put information online and that we use to, you know, to find it, all of that stuff is the same as it was in 1995 when HTTP spec came out. I mean, it's certainly, there are way more complicated things that you can do now, but the networks, the protocols, you know, a lot of that stuff is at its core, it's the same. And in that core, there are effectively no gatekeepers. It really is, again, kind of like a great protocol that was developed for with users in mind. It's not no cost, but for a few dollars, you can put something online and somebody, you know, people in most other countries across the globe could find it or can access it right away if they know that it's there. So I think the fact that that is all still true, there's certainly an education component. Like a lot of people don't know that that's true or don't, you know, have any reason to care. And I think we can still get the word out about that. We can still do the things that we want to do in the ways that we want to do them for the most part ourselves. All of those things I think are great and are still true and don't are unaffected by the, you know, big tech messaging that, you know, our platforms are everything you need.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point about, like you did say, that they're not no cost. You know, you said for a few dollars, and I think that's a really good point to stress. It's like, I think big tech did a really good job of like the entry level, like this is all free. It's all free. Like, you can just do this, but
yeah,
it isn't. Like it costs electricity. It costs people to do the thing, and sort of that message trivialized all of the other stuff, and it made it go away. And people are in just a different state of mind at this point. You know, people, you know, balking at paying $5 for an app on the App Store. It's like, oh, $5 app? Really? You just spent $7 on your Starbucks this morning, and that was just for one, and you consumed it, and it's now gone. But you're not going to pay $5 for an app that you're never going to have to spend again. It's now, but you can just own it. And so, yeah, like that's part of the educational message with the things that we're trying to like build and do as part of like small tech as well. It's like there are humans that are building these things that they deserve to be compensated, donated, supported to continue to do.
I'm optimistic, but I'm also keeping an observant eye on what's going on in the world, because I think a lot of what happened in the 80s and the 90s was there was a lot of very, very, you know, smart people that had very good intentions in what they put out in the world. And I think those specs were fantastic, and I think they had the right goals in mind. And I think while they still exist, I think they're, as we spoke about earlier, like the sort of legal climate in the world has changed. Like just even things like, you know, big tech, the big ISPs of the world out there, it's like stopping people running their own like broadband service in their small towns and things like that. There's legal challenges that are coming up that if we're not careful will allow big tech to continue to run roughshod over the actual technology itself. So I like I said, I'm still optimistic about the underlying technology itself. I do think from a legal and from a societal aspect, we do need to pay attention to what big companies are trying to do and make sure that they don't overstep.
I totally agree with that. And I think at the network level, we're still very dependent on lots of things that are largely out of our control. And I think to the extent that people, you know, I don't know, to the extent that organizations want to be able to leverage some influence over how people use the internet, the network level is an obvious target.
So henhouse ISP. After static hosting.
All right.
Mesh core.
There we go.
Well, Corey, thank you so much. We'll have all your links in our show notes. We really appreciate you joining us. Next month, we'll be talking about worker co-ops, specifically tech worker co-ops. I've been doing some research, learned that I think they just, so 2025, there were more small businesses created in the United States than any year in history. So people are out there starting companies, entrepreneurial spirit. We think the best model to do that is with a co-op. and we'll get into why. We'll have some really cool guests from the movement to talk about those things, but we're going to specifically focus on how it pertains to tech type of businesses. We love grocery co-ops and everything, but for our audience, it's, you know, how to start your own tech co-op is basically what we're going to talk about. So that'll be next month. You can visit us online and find all of our links and so forth at limeleaf.coop, limeleaf.coop. And again, head over to henhouse.coop, henhouse.coop, if you want to learn more about that. There's a link there to our open collective where you can contribute to the project. And at the $50 membership level, then when we finally get this thing all incorporated, you'll be an official voting member owner of a co-op. You can brag about that with at Thanksgiving with your family. Explain to them what a co-op is. So, all right, until next month, that's the Lime Leaf Podcast. Thanks again, Corey.
Thank you.
Thanks, Corey.
Thank you.